The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Okay, the other headline of the day, we love it. It's Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan, and his annual letter. Lots of things to get through on this one. You know, he says that AI could augment virtually every job. So that was sort of the one thing he did talk about. Obviously, he doesn't like lots of regulation in Basel III. So let's dig into it. Allison Williams, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Analyst, Global Banks and Asset Managers, joins us now. All right, Allison, what were some of the takeaways here?
So I think, you know, it's always interesting to hear what's on Jamie's mind. I think some things are consistent. He gives his views on regulation, which he feels like there definitely needs to be some changes, as well as the policy and the political front. You know, one of the interesting things this year was the 20-year look back. It's the anniversary of the J.P. Morgan Bank One deal. As you may remember, Bank One was actually the buyer of J.P. Morgan, and I was lucky enough to be at the dinner that night with the CEOs of both Bank One and J.P. Morgan, and certainly did not anticipate where we'd be, you know, 20 years later, but did anticipate that Jamie Dimon, even I think at that time, showed himself to be a patient CEO. He waited to take the job. He was selective. He took the job with Bank One. He was selective about the J.P. Morgan deal. He stored up his capital and was in a good position at the crisis. And so, you know, today when we're seeing a lot of headlines around some of his concerns, and again, certainly he does outline a lot of these in the annual report, it just really just puts into mind that the risk manager that he is. And so while there's a lot of headlines about his talk about inflation, he's been very vocal about the world needing to be prepared for higher rates. I think it's just a way that he does his job and manages his company, thinking about the downsides, thinking about the risks out there, and sort of always being prepared to be in the best position he can.
All right, Allison. So those are, you know, we always look to that letter for some long-term trend issues, and he calls out AI in particular this time. How about the short-term stuff? We're going to hear about the short-term stuff this Friday with the earnings starting. What are you looking for from JPM and maybe from some of the other big banks that we care about?
Sure. And you know, there were a lot of call outs about the great job that they've been doing, the great year that they had last year. And we really think that this quarter they're going to continue to, you know, execute on all cylinders. I think that the net interest income story, as you know, that's sort of the big thing that everyone's watching. We've had a big shift in the market view on rates since the last time these banks have reported. But we think that J.P. Morgan will continue to show resilience in that net interest income and surprise investors positively on that front. Part of that is the credit card business, where it just continues to show very strong growth. And part of it is the deposit pricing, which has come in a little bit better than expected. So we think that's going to help J.P. Morgan. It's going to help Bank of America. The card side helping J.P. Morgan and Citigroup a little bit more, but also we may see provisions tick up, but that's not because of the weaker environment. It's more because the card loan growth continues to be strong. It's normalizing, and this tends to be the seasonally higher quarter for card losses. So think that we could get more resilient net interest income, but also higher provisions.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because last week, Goldman Sachs' Marcus, lowered the rate on its savings account, high yield savings account, which is 10 basis points, and I obviously use it. And I was like, dude, we haven't even had a rate cut. What are we doing? But that's clearly going to be good for these guys, but bad for me.
Yeah. So, I mean, for on the deposit front, you know, really a year ago, I think it became big news with all the bank turmoil that deposit prices were going up, and consumers, I think, that saw those headlines, if they hadn't already been getting the yield, they were going after it. And so the yields have gone up. We saw the yields on loans go up, and then we saw the yields on deposits go up. And now we're at a place where, you know, the question is, will those deposit prices continue to go up and sort of eat away at the yield? The reason why banks are, or one benefit of banks, of if the rate cuts come, is that those prices will come down, as you said. But then, you know, there, for all of these banks, there is a question of, you know, the deposits and what they can do with those deposits. Excuse me. And there is a competitive aspect to it. And so there are times when banks are more aggressively pricing, and there are times when, you know, as you said, for Goldman Sachs, maybe they're less aggressively pricing. Maybe they see, you know, less of a need of what they can do with that money, or balance sheet management, because as we know, there is a cost to capital to fund that balance sheet. There are higher capital requirements. There are other things you can do with your capital. And so I think these all kind of go into the mix of what banks are thinking.
Hey, Allison, are we going to hear anything this quarter from the banks about commercial real estate and the problems it may pose for the U.S., economy and maybe the banking system? Or is that just a regional bank thing?
I think, you know, it will continue to tick up. I think it is a broad, bank thing, but the regional banks, it's just more important to their earnings. So I was speaking before about card. If you look at card, the banks that I cover, you know, especially JP Morgan, Citi, Wells, and Bank of America tend to be over-indexed to card, less so to commercial real estate. Of those four banks, Wells Fargo is really the one that sort of has a commercial real estate exposure similar to the regional peers. They have the largest U.S. office exposure across the banks I cover, but they also have an 8% reserve already against those loans. So they've been very conservative on that book. I think the newer worry, if you will, is the multifamily lending business. New York Community really sort of brought that to light. JP Morgan has the closest business to that, but they've talked about some underwriting protections they have there, just in terms of how they look at rents and the way they underwrite, being much more conservative. And so they've had very good performance in that book over a long period of time. Still, you know, people are going to look at it, but it's more of sort of a very long-term story for the banks.
I'm having a hard time getting excited about JP Morgan kicking off earnings on Friday. What's going to be for me, sort of, and for you, the biggest surprise? Like, what are you most jazzed about watching when it comes to all the big banks, all the asset managers, all the guys?
I mean, I think the biggest surprise will be that net interest income resilience, and just the fact that it does come in better than expected. You know, it was interesting last quarter, all the banks generally beat on net interest income, but guided down. And so the stocks acted very negatively towards that. This quarter, I think there will be the resilience in the net interest income that could surprise to the upside. They will adjust the outlooks. The latter is expected. I think the other thing that I'll be focusing on, investors are going to be focusing on, is those investment banking fees. So there's been a lot of talk about bullishness for those fees. We also think that we could see a big jump in the fees, but we're still nowhere near compared to where we were at the 2021. So, you could see a big jump in fees, but the questions are going to be, you know, how are things trending? IPOs, the volumes have been good, but, you know, there's still a lot of questions from investors around some of the performance. We've had some good performers. There have been some not so good performers. We still have some valuations that, investors are waiting to get better. They don't want to go public and have to mark down those investments. So I think the pipelines and the investment banking fees are going to be, I guess, one of the more exciting things this quarter, Alex. You know, maybe not as exciting as we had hoped for earlier in the year.
Yeah. All right, we'll see. All right, Allison Williams, thanks so much for joining us. Allison Williams, she's a senior analyst. She covers all the big banks on a global basis. She does that for Bloomberg Intelligence. Before that, she alluded to, she was at Morgan Stanley Investment Management on the buy side, and where she covered the banks. And of course, when a couple of big banks get together, they need to court their large shareholders, and Morgan Stanley Investment Management is certainly one of those. So that's why Allison was on the front lines. And when those two, J.P. Morgan Chase, the predecessor, and the bank from Ohio, I can't think of the name.
Bank One. I bet she's not watching the eclipse because she's hard at work. So, I mean, exactly. I'm just saying. But I'm also looking at multiple countdown clocks now. Are we counting down to the eclipse special? Are we counting down to the actual eclipse? I'm just saying. This is a lot happening.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence Radio. We bring you all the top analysts from all our great coverage. We cover about 2,000 companies in 130 industries worldwide. We are broadcasting to you live from our Interactive Brokers studio right here in Midtown Manhattan. You can also check us on YouTube. So Bloomberg Intelligence has an amazing arm of analysts, cover companies and themes. We also have something here at Bloomberg called Bloomberg New Energy Finance. And the idea behind it is to provide data on commodities, power, transport, industry, buildings, and agriculture, as well as new technology as we kind of build a more sustainable world, right? We know we're transitioning, and we know we have to get there. And how you finance it is the huge question. And there's a big gap between like the VC things and then the scalable stuff. And helping to finance that gap is very tricky. So we thought every Monday we would bring you an amazing analyst from BNEF and sort of talk through some of these issues that we're confronting. So this time we're going to talk about EV charging. So Ryan Fisher is Bloomberg BNEF EV charging team leader, and he joins us now from London. So I guess just to start off, who are the big players in EV charging?
Yeah, so some of them maybe not quite household names yet, but you've got ChargePoint in the US, certainly people may have heard of, and the sentiment was pretty positive a few years ago, stock prices up, and then everything has kind of crashed down, sentiment not so great. Some of these companies have not met the targets that they might have done. But what we're starting to see is a few companies that you definitely won't have heard of actually have started to post some positive profit margins. So there's like fast charger manufacturers in Europe called Kempower, making the kind of units that can send big power to EVs and charge it fast. And then you've got some of the ones who do the slower power units as well. And then also you've got a couple of these companies that you may have heard of, like ABB, producing chargers as part of a portfolio. So they're selling transformers, and they're sort of using that as somewhat of a way to get into companies and sell some of their other products that they've got and add it on as an additional. So lots going on the hardware side. And then you've got operators. So these are like the companies who basically will sell the electricity to charge a vehicle. You kind of think of it like filling up with petrol. None of those so far are profitable, but we have seen some good signs. So some of those being EBITDA positive now. Fastned posted that, which is a Dutch one, the other day. In the US, none profitable so far, but there's a company called EVgo. You may have heard of who has these fast chargers. Mm-hmm. And they actually basically delivered 191% more energy in 2023 than they had in 2022. So good progress there.
So, Ryan, where are we kind of, I guess, on a timeline of kind of getting enough charging capabilities into the system that can really support, you know, a wide adoption of EVs? It feels like we've hit a speed bump here. What's the timeline, do you think, when you talk to folks in the industry?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because we cover the global market. So you look at China, and they installed about 1 million of these public chargers last year, and the US did sort of low tens of thousands. So there's a big difference depending on where you are in the world. I think the US and Europe are more similar in how they'll play out, and Europe is maybe just 5 years ahead. So Europe has got actually loads of competition at the moment, and the story a little bit when we look at this is some of the companies looking like competition is starting to weigh on the demand that they're delivering because it's a bit monopolistic. So I want the best land as a company, and I want the best grid connection, and I want that to be somewhere that people are going and somewhere where people can buy things. And they realize that, well, the demand isn't quite there yet, but if we believe in the long-term trajectory of EVs, let's get in this business, let's get those spots. So we've seen that in Europe, and I think the US is just starting to tick over. The US has been hugely dominated by Tesla. So if you look at Tesla on the vehicle side, kind of 80% of these pure battery electric vehicles 5 years ago, kind of Teslas. And then they also provide the supercharging, and that's kind of pushed all the competition out. But what we saw last year was some of these other automakers really producing the EVs, and therefore providing a market for other people to come into. But the US slightly behind, basically the global, maybe just because Tesla has this dominance in the market.
This is a super dumb question. Where does a charging operator get the power to then enable me to put a Tesla into that network?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So there has been a lot of these companies that are going out and they're saying, do you know what? Instead of putting two chargers in at my petrol station where the power exists, I actually now need kind of 12 chargers. And in some cases, when you look at, for example, the Tesla stations, they've got like 100 chargers in one spot. Now that becomes a big grid connection. The next thing is charging the trucks. So this could be like the same amount of power as a town. And a lot of the utilities are taking too long to do it. So it's like the how long does it take to get a permit? How long does it take to actually get energized? Can you make the agreements with the land leaser? All of this has kind of slowed it down. But clearly, industry is trying to work together, and this has become a big topic for the automakers and the utilities as well. Some of them trying to sign contracts on site. So if you imagine these companies, small fry, like several small meters across multiple places, the utilities may be not so interested in that. But now they're actually delivering a lot of demand. So as I say, looking to other markets in the US and China being a good example, the public chargers in China now deliver more energy than the whole of Ireland. So lots of
Wow.
energy, and therefore that becomes interesting because if you're an energy developer and you're doing like solar on site next to it with a battery, and we've seen Watt EV, which is one of these truck charging companies, basically build a station that's not connected to the grid at all. It's just got straight to the solar and a battery. So cool innovations going on there.
Hey, Ryan, here in the US, EV sales have slowed materially, and a lot of people are trying to think there's a combination of reasons, price being a big one, and but one of those drivers is just the lack of a fully ubiquitous charging infrastructure. When you talk to your EV companies, how do they think about it? Are they concerned about the long-term demand of EVs in general? And if so, do they feel like they can be part of the solution there?
Yeah, and there's definitely kind of differences in opinions. The US Hyundai CEO saying something along the lines of today, why buy an EV from an automaker who's lobbying against EVs? And obviously he's talking about the US there, but you do see a difference in those that are kind of in on it and those that aren't. And I think some who aren't have previously been so. They've committed billions, they've talked about targets, and then they're starting to row it back. And some of that is maybe because the technology is behind. They can't do it as cheap as everyone else. So there's different reasons. And I think when you look at liabilities, I don't think that's talked about enough, actually. Some of these companies have put cars out there, and then the battery's had a problem, and they've got to recall it, and that could be multi-billions. So I think there's some caution as well in saying, why don't we put a few less cars out? Because then we can learn from them, and we can do it later. Some of the narrative has been they're not putting the cars out because quite physically the battery operations are not up and running. But I think there is other reasons.
Ryan, hey, look, this was great. We really appreciate it. Ryan Fisher, Bloomberg BNEF EV charging head. And we'll be doing this every Monday, talking
Cool.
about different areas within the energy transition. This is why Paul stuck with me, because I'm going to
Yeah,
make him talk about
very good
all
stuff.
this stuff. But interesting that you might have, like, what, little power centers around EV charging networks.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Works.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Barry, founder and managing partner at Threadneedle, is joining us. Equity's doing nothing. A bond yield's up a little bit. But before we get to all that fun stuff, Anne, are you watching the eclipse?
I absolutely wouldn't miss it. I remember the last one 7 years ago, Alex, and just standing out in Central Park with armies full of people. So I'm hoping to repeat the experience again today. It's a lot of fun.
All right, so she's not eclipsed out. Fine. No. Are you bond yield out at this point? That's my way of asking, like, hey, how much higher can yields go at this point?
Yeah, I got to tell you, Alex, I've for a while now stopped looking at bond yields as an indicator of where I should be putting capital to work. These usual indicators haven't been as consistent over the last couple of years. And so I've just really gone back to good old fashioned fundamentals, esoteric signs, looking specifically at what might be good catalysts for the stocks individually to try and see where to play right now.
All right. So where are you guys, as you think about just kind of M&A in general, what's kind of your outlook here for the remainder of 2024? Because we've got, you know, equity markets higher, but rates are still higher as well.
They are, but I do think that the actual backdrop for M&A this year has gotten a lot more interesting. If you think back over the last 2 years and you put yourself in the position of the boards of public companies, and I've been there, it's been a really difficult place to say yay or nay to getting deals done. We've seen a bit of an exception in the oil and gas space, Alex, that I know is your forte. And the reason for that lack of activity has been, yes, partly financing has obviously been a lot more expensive, whether it's been in cash deals or stock deals, but also because you just didn't want to be the board member who looked like a bit of a schmuck if you got the call wrong, because the macro is just so volatile and a lot of the key factors you want. You didn't want to be selling too cheaply or buying too expensively. I think things have settled down a little bit now, which gives people more confidence to go out and buy. And I do think that we're going to see some names forced to do some M&A activity. And specifically, there are what I call these fallen angels from that 2020, 2021 pandemic era darling period, where I think some of these names are going to have to diversify or die, and it's going to force them to go and do some M&A.
So how do you play all of that? So, okay, if you're bond yielded out, so you're looking less at that, you're looking at the fundamentals, you do think M&A could be, it sounds like a catalyst. Talk to me about the sectors first in that you want to play.
Well, let's take a look at consumer, for example, Alex. And, you know, that's one where you've got a history, if you go back in time, where deals tended to be, first of all, they were a lot bigger. So you saw lots of mass consolidation and sort of mergers of equals. And then you had the shift towards consumer brands in food, and beauty, and apparel, trying to buy these high growth challenger brands with really fast top line growth, but less of a focus on profitability. We look at what happened last year. We saw Campbell's go and buy Sovos Brands. That was a $2.8 billion deal. And I think that's because in food, for example, you're going to see the fact that inflation's not gone completely. The consumers, though, not going to keep putting up with price increases, and the cost base has seen a step function up. Organic growth on the margin level and on the top line level has slowed down. So I think that's going to force more M&A, the likes of which we started to see last year again with Campbell. One specific company, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm sort of testing the thesis. I look at something, Alex, like Olaplex. Do you remember when that went public? When we were all sitting at home, mm-hmm. The valuation on that hair and shampoo company was absolutely astronomical. It's now trading at a fraction, single digit fraction of where it was. But it's a good cash flow business. It's got a smart backer at Advent, a private equity firm that knows what it's doing. That business, in my opinion, is going to have to go and buy other brands to regain the trust of the public market again. So I would look at that as a potential acquirer. It's got the means to do it. And that's the kind of thesis I find a little bit contrarian and interesting right now.
And talk to us about the private equity and the private credit business. How ready are those two folks willing to commit to M&A here? It would seem like the private equity folks, they've been holding on to a lot of assets a lot longer than they probably would like to. So they have some incentive to get deals done. Are they going to be a player?
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a terrific point. They've got an incentive to get deals done because a lot of deals were done 6 or 7 years ago. So traditional private equity is now a little bit past the horizon to get out of those investments. The other piece of this is, too, if you think about when a deal is done at inception, a lot of leverage is often put on these private companies. And a lot of those debt maturities are coming up. Private equity firms don't necessarily want to recapitalize them with much more expensive debt and be stuck holding them for longer. I think they'd rather sell than deal with that maturity wall. So I think you're going to have a lot of willing sellers. And I do think this, again, is going to be an opportunity where buyers now that the macro has died down, will start sharpening their pencils, look at the cash balances they've accumulated. And I think we'll start seeing strategics perhaps being a lot more active in buying private equity assets than they were before.
Okay, so I get all of this. But at what point, though, do you need to start looking at yields again? Like, if we get a stronger CPI, like, your thesis is sound. What if rates hit 5%?
Yeah, look, I think that rates have been expected to be higher for longer. And I think the street's actually been re-underwriting that thesis, Alex, for quite a long time. And I think they've sort of got past the point of sticker shock. I think the other piece that I would say when it comes to bond yields and looking at treasuries as the peg is, one of my theses coming into this year is the importance of fiscal policy for really dictating what appetite was going to be around a lot of these debt plays. And one thing that's been interesting to me in watching the election, which if anything is going to be one of the big influences in terms of shocks to that thesis, none of the key presidential candidates are coming out right now with much daylight between them on the fiscal policy front, at least nothing concrete, although no shocks or surprises. So I'm just still continuing to think that bond yields, yes, they're important. Yes, that cost of financing is critical. But in terms of catalysts to move markets, I just don't see them at this particular moment.
So, and just as it relates to financing deals here, you know, these rates, they're still by historical standards, these rates are not terribly high, but for the average CEO, CFO, and board member, they feel really high relative to the past decade or here. So how much of a hindrance is that to just getting deals done?
I think it has been a hindrance, but I don't think that it's going to continue to be a hindrance, because one thing that has changed in this narrative is a level of confidence that at some point, yes, inflation will come down and yes, interest rates will come down. Now, what obviously has changed is the pace at which that is going to take place. You remember the 6 rate cuts that some of the most aggressive analysts had on the docket for this year? It's now gone to maybe 2, right? So the pace of decline is coming down. But if we look forward not to 2025, but we look to 2026, you know, you can see a deal being negotiated at some point towards the second half of this year. It probably won't close until 2025, by which time we hope some rate action will have taken place. And you can see corporates being a little bit more confident that there'll be a slightly lower interest rate environment when it comes to actually executing against a plan to deliver synergies against. So again, you're absolutely right, higher than recent history, but manageable.
So you mentioned consumers, consumer stocks in terms of M&A. Other areas that we've seen, right? We've seen a ton in the biotech space, which we tend to see normally, right? Yeah. We see energy. We also hear a lot about potential software deals because there's just so many software players and regional banks. Where do you think is the most likely?
In terms of likely activity, I think we'll continue to see consolidation, Alex, in the Permian, in the oil and gas space, where scale really is critical and where you've got these absolutely asset-intensive companies. You need to get those benefits of scale. So that's one space I think we'll continue to spend activity. I don't spend a ton of time there. I have in the past, but I do think we'll see activity there. When it comes to software, I think that this is an interesting space. It's still very expensive. But one area that I do think the strategics will start to go shopping a little bit more aggressively is buying some of these private companies backed by venture capital, backed by growth stage equity firms, where valuations are now a bit more sensible. And there are some real buyers of choice out there. You know, when I talk to the private side community in tech, Salesforce is where people want to sell their businesses to. Palo Alto Networks, if you're in cyber. Very healthy balance sheets, lots of free cash flow. And if you look back in history, and McKinsey had a very interesting piece out on it in recent weeks, programmatic M&A, which is lots of acquisitions behind a thesis rather than a really one really big mega merger, has tended to actually generate quite good incremental shareholder returns above the average by about 200 basis points. And so I do think looking at some of those historical M&A machines who know what they're doing on integration will be interesting.
Interesting. Anne, thanks a lot. Really great stuff. Really enjoy it. Have fun at the eclipse today. Anne Berry, founder and managing partner at Threadneedle Paul. And John, and what's your name again? John Tucker. We'll join you there.
with his welding helmet.
He has a welding helmet, apparently, not glasses.
Yeah, that gig didn't work out, but I kept the helmet.
Because you never know when an eclipse.
You never know.
You never know when you're going to need that welding helmet. I want to see what your garage looks like.
I actually don't have a garage. I have a shed. Large shed. And
with
the basement,
gear.
You can't even move in there. There's so many tools.
with old welding gear.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, well, let's go to someone who's probably not eclipsed out yet, and that is Julie Fine. She's Bloomberg Texas Bureau Chief, and she's standing by. I mean, it's not that I don't think it's cool. It just, it's a lot. It's a lot. Are you eclipsed out?
I'm getting eclipsed out. Yesterday I was in Target and I was like in the line for self-checkout for like 20 minutes. It's just so crowded here. I think you think about a Super Bowl when, you know, a stadium holds roughly 100,000 people. So you probably have 200,000 people in town. Right now in the Dallas area, the mayor estimates 400,000
really?
People in town.
So people are coming there because Dallas is in the totality area? Is that the story?
Dallas is totality. We get totality for 3 minutes and 51 seconds, to be exact. So Dallas is in totality. So we have a lot of people in town, and you can certainly feel it.
That means, okay, to be fair, I mean, I may joke, but this is, there's a definite economic impact here. Like, how much could Texas make off of this thing?
A leading economist estimates over $400 million for the entire state, because there's areas that are in almost totality, like Austin and Houston. You've got the Hill Country. I mean, hotels are jammed. My family said to me on Friday, we should try to come in for the eclipse, and you're looking at, you know, to even get here was $1,200 on Sunday.
Oh, my God.
Well, okay. Governor
I said, this is a little late to think about that.
Exactly. Well, Governor Hochul, Governor Hochul for the state of New York is telling people, like, because another one is up in Buffalo and Niagara Falls.
Well, fun fact, that's where I'm from.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm all eclipsed today. And in Buffalo, it's supposed to be better forecast, actually, than here in Dallas. We're a little overcast here. But Buffalo apparently is jammed with people as well.
It is actually quite interesting. If you look at like an Airbnb map, this came out on X like a few weeks ago, I guess, and you just saw exactly where the line was of where the eclipse was going to go, sold out Airbnb. So to your point. All right, Julie, what else are you going to be watching? Kind of what are some of the highlights here?
Well, I think there was some questions about the power grid, because solar will be affected for a short period of time, but the power grid in Texas seems very prepared to handle that. So we'll be watching that. You know, our office is smack in the middle of downtown, so they're actually blocking entrances and exits for an hour or so. What's really interesting is we're supposed to have severe weather this evening. So obviously everybody will be paying attention to that. It'll be really interesting. And actually, you know, hopefully people are smart about when they choose to travel and come in and out of town if there's a horrible rainstorm and everybody's kind of trying to get out of Dallas.
Big D. They do things big in Texas.
That sounds fun.
Everything's bigger here and better.
All right, yeah, I do think that the solar thing is also kind of interesting. But again, if you're prepped for it, maybe it's not that big of a deal. All right, Julie, thank you so much. Have fun. Be safe. Julie Fine, Bloomberg, Texas Bureau Chief, joining us there.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Again, if you think about where we are, where we were back in October to where we are now, S&P 500 up over 25%, just a big, big move. Big first quarter as well to kind of finish that off. And we got a little bit more green here today. So the question for a lot of folks is, boy, that was quick. And did I miss that move in the market? Let's check in with Walter Todd. He does this stuff for a living. He's a president, Chief Investment Officer, Managing Director at Greenwood Capital. And Walter, I'm guessing you're in South Carolina?
I am. I've got my eclipse glasses ready for the for the viewing later today.
And I'm guessing you're pretty happy after your Lady Gamecocks last night put on a heck of a show.
Yeah, congratulations. Got to give a shout out to Dawn Staley and the team for a great win, undefeated season. Pretty incredible.
Yes, amazing. All right, Walter, what are you telling your clients here about kind of these markets, where they've moved, where the opportunities are? What are you saying to your clients these days?
Yeah, well, as you kind of alluded to in the lead-in here, it's been quite a move off the lows. And, you know, it's this year has been a little bit hard to figure out, quite honestly, for me. I mean, the move off the lows in October when rates peaked at 5 and the S&P started to rise as rates fell, that made a lot of sense. But as we sit here today, you know, up almost 10% for the first quarter for the S&P, you know, rates have risen. The expectation for Fed cuts has gone from 7 to less than 3. So it's a little bit puzzling to see the market kind of screaming in that with that backdrop. Having said that, you know, the reason for the rate cut push out is because economic data has been better, and that should be good for earnings. I think, you know, depending on your time horizon, in the very short term, it feels like this market's a little bit tired, kind of churning here. We're seeing some rotation underneath the surface. So I think you can kind of bide your time a little bit here and look for opportunities in the volatility that we think will come. But again, it reminds me of the quote from Mark Twain, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble, it's what you know for sure that just ain't so.
Yeah, and Walter, that really depends on the volatility actually materializing. What does that volatility look like, and what do you think finally causes that?
Yeah, well, I think we got a little bit of a peek at that last week. If you look at the action on Thursday, from the comments from Kashkari Thursday afternoon, and then the geopolitical issues going on in the Middle East, you saw the market drop 2% basically from high to low in a couple of hours. So that's, I think, a little snapshot of what could happen. I mean, we'll see what happens with the CPI report on Wednesday. You know, if that were to come out a little bit hot, we could see some more volatility. But you're right. I mean, it's been incredibly low volatility. Backdrop for markets really off the lows from last October. So there's no guarantee that it will emerge, but I think the odds are that it likely will as a function of probably higher rates being the catalyst there.
Walter, what are you guys doing in the fixed income space here? I mean, I can just park myself for a two-year treasury and get 4.78%. That's not too bad.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think on the fixed income side, when we have managed a good number of fixed income assets, I mean, we take a barbell approach on that, you know, as you say, you know, taking advantage of the short end, but also, you know, taking advantage of rates moving higher and starting to step out a little bit on the duration spectrum, but still staying, you know, shorter than the index. The other aspect of fixed income is corporate spreads. Those are extremely tight right now. And kind of back to the previous point about where's the volatility going to come from. You really haven't seen, anytime you've seen volatility in the equity market, the little that we've seen, you really haven't seen spreads react. And so we're kind of watching that to see it kind of as a coincident indicator to validate any type of sell-off maybe has some legs on the corporate bond market. So we're actually transitioning a little bit of weight out of corporates into treasuries as a result of those tight spreads.
Yeah, you know, you and everybody else have been waiting for those spreads to change. It's really fascinating. Do you think we see for the 10-year 3% or 5% first?
That's a great question. I think we could see a push back towards 5%. In that direction, whether we clip it or not, and get back to those highs from October. I'm not sure, but I think directionally we're going to move towards 5% before we head back below 4 and maybe head towards 3 as we move through this year. Because the other dynamic here is the federal government just continues to run deficits and spend, you know, have deficit spending, which has really kind of been the support for financial markets in the economy. If you look over the past several years, we've been running, you know, 5% deficits year after year, which is, you know, certainly helpful to the economic environment and financial conditions.
So on the equity side here, where are you seeing opportunities here? Are you kind of all in with some of those big growth stocks that have been powering the market really for the last 18 months, the NVIDIAs of the world, or are you looking for maybe some value in other spots?
Yeah, for us, it's kind of a barbell. So we certainly have exposure to, you know, technology, not NVIDIA specifically, but other technology names within the index, because that is, I think, a multi-year kind of growth dynamic with AI. But probably getting a little bit stretched here in the short term. On the flip side, we see, also see opportunities and want to have some exposure to the value side of the equation. So think energy, materials, industrials. And that's something we've really seen over the past month is kind of this emerging inflation trade, mm-hmm. where you've seen, you know, the commodities kind of catch a bid here. Industrials have been consistently good, particularly down the cap scale. So we believe you want to have a balance within the portfolio between the growth and the value.
You mentioned energy. Thank you very much. So how do you want to play that? Like, what's the best way to play the recent outperformance?
Yeah, Alex, I know you're a big energy energy fan there and follower and expert. Within the portfolio, we have a variety of different exposures there. So certainly on the E&P front, I think this M&A that we've seen over the past year is going to continue. As we move through the rest of this year and into 2025, we also have exposures to some of the big integrated names like Exxon and Chevron and different strategies. We don't have a ton of exposure to the equipment and service space right now, but I know that's been catching up a little bit to the broader energy space. So we think having a broad exposure within energy and quite frankly, you know, it's just 4% of the S&P. So you can have, you know, a pretty good overweight with just 6-7% of the portfolio in there. And we still think this dynamic of, you know, NVIDIA, for example, being larger than the entire energy space, just doesn't make a whole lot of common sense to us. So we think there are opportunities in the energy space.
How about in healthcare? A lot of folks are suggesting that could be a defensive area, but still some growth, I guess.
Yeah, healthcare has been disappointing. Certainly disappointing. It was great in 2022 when the market was off. It was, you know, lagged last year. Started to kind of emerge early this year, but has fallen back off. We see a lot of value within healthcare. Whether that be pharmaceuticals, biotech, healthcare equipment, but certainly has lagged the overall market. But we definitely have a healthy weight within that sector and see opportunities. One of the challenges for healthcare is it is an election year. Which tends to be a little bit of a headwind for those names.
What don't you like right now? Like, what's like verboten where you are?
Yeah, so we're underweight consumer discretionary right now. Mm-hmm. We're underweight real estate and utilities as interest rate sensitive sectors, and we're actually slightly underweight technology, which I know is a seems like a crazy thing right now. But again, we think a little bit stretched here in the short term, given the move that we've seen, over the past 18 months in that sector.
Yeah, that's so funny. It's like you don't want it, but you have to have it, but it's stretched. That's a tricky spot, definitely, to be.
Yep.
That's why people get paid
Absolutely.
To do this stuff, man.
That's true. That's why I don't do that.
Walter Todd, thank you so much for joining us here. President, Chief Investment Officer, Managing Director, Greenwood Capital, coming to us from the great state of South Carolina, in Greenwood, South Carolina, where I guess the whole state's going nuts. Mm-hmm. I know Amy Mars is at Bloomberg News down in Washington. We chatted with her this morning. She was overcome with emotion talking about her University of South Carolina.
Sports?
Lady Gamecocks.
Sports.
Women's basketball.
Yeah, no, yes. I'm kidding. I do know. Paul's looking at me like, come on, Alex. Like, get it a little bit together. I got a little bit together for that.
Got a little bit together. Yeah, so that was a lot of fun for those folks down there.
But
so
we're done with that now. We're moving on to the men's match, right? When's that?
9:20 tonight, so I'm not even going to see
Yikers.
The tip-off.
9:20?
Exactly.
Wait, we got an Eclipse and the Final Four in one day?
And you got Coach Calipari leaving Kentucky for Arkansas. Perhaps the biggest news of the day.
Wow.
See? She has no idea.
I don't. I really don't. No,
this is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.